Gracias por descargar este podcast de Hey Festival. Para más información sobre nuestros festivales internacionales y sobre cómo acceder a nuestro archivo, por favor visite heyfestival.org. Gracias.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Can you all hear me okay? Fantastic. My name is Jonathan Levi, and I'm delighted to be moderating this session on translation here at the beautiful Santa Clara, the chapel of the Hotel Santa Clara at the Hay Festival in Cartagena. I've been coming down to the Hay Festival for a number of years, and it gets better and better and more interesting, and with more and more interesting people in the audience. And this time I'd especially like to welcome a number of international journalists who I have the honor of working with this year, journalists who come from India, from Nigeria, from Hungary, Latvia, Brazil, Portugal, and every country in Latin America. So really the Hay Festival is a gathering of international people and international languages. And that's why I think that translation is so important today. It's the way that we get to know other peoples, other cultures, and yet it's something that is almost transparent to the point of being invisible. And it's important sometimes to recognize that there is somebody, as in the Wizard of Oz, behind that curtain, pulling the levers, making one language turn into another. And so I'm very pleased today to have two guests. One of them was actually listed in your program, Philip Baim, who's here to my left, who translates from the German, from the Polish, and is most well known here at the festival for being the translator of Erta Müller, who many of you may have heard yesterday in conversation with Philip. And I was originally supposed to have another guest, Edith Grossman, who is a friend of mine back in New York, but is better known as the translator of Gabriel Garcia Marquez since the time of Love in the Time of Cholera, and I think forward here. Edith has never been to Colombia. She hates getting on airplanes. And once again, she's been true to form. She's not here, unfortunately, with us. So my apologies for you who came wanting to hear Edith, but we have a treat. Because yesterday in the courtyard of the Santa Clara, I saw wandering through there a writer. I live in Rome now, but a writer who I recognize because he is one of the great living Italian writers that we have, not only in the world of literature, but the world of theater. He is a polymath who translates from a number of different languages, and that's Eri De Luca, who is here with us as well. So, welcome to you, both of you gentlemen, and I thought maybe let's start by making this a class for the audience, and tell us, what do translators actually do? Do you just take the book and put it into Google Translate and then fix it, or do you, tell me, I mean, Eri, what do you do? You've translated from ancient Hebrew and from Yiddish. Those are the two main languages that you've translated from. What do you do?
There are different mobiles for the reason to study a language and translate it. For ancient Hebrew, it depends on the fact that this is the language of our religious civilization. Monotheism has been built, written, said in Hebrew, ancient Hebrew, before then in other languages. In a kind of way, God spoke Hebrew first time. When he said, Yei or, it will be the light, he said it in Hebrew. And so my intention is to approach this spring, this well of the monotheism, directly, passing on the translation and the centuries, directly with my little glass at the serves at the...
You know, it's interesting that you said that. Recently, in the recent American elections, there was a debate in one of the states about adding Spanish as an official language. And somebody said that since God spoke in English, that ought to be good enough for all of us. And it was... so...
And there is, I think there are two reasons for translating.
Yeah.
And one, two approach. You can translate for because you admire or because you are envious. Mm-hmm. And the difference is that if you admire, you just stay at your place. You cannot imagine that you can move to in the place of the author you are translating. If you are envious, you want to put your fingertip on the text. You
so
want to
which
be
were
at
you?
Place of in the
which
place.
Which were you? Were you?
I admire.
You admire.
I admire. I stay far. Uh-huh. I stay on my place, and I try to be the most faithful and loyal to the page that I am admiring.
Now, Philip, do those words apply to what you do? Do faithful, loyal, are those relevant words?
I tend to think. I tend to think a little differently. For me, the approach to a text is I close my eyes and open my ears, and each book has a voice or several voices, and each language has a voice or several voices. So it's like listening to music. Mm-hmm. And then once I hear the voice in the original, once I hear the music in the original, then I set about transposing it into a different key.
Mm-hmm.
That might be how I think of it. I sometimes to capture the resonance of a certain sound. I mean, there are some registers that we don't have in English that exist in other languages, and those require a little more intervention, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But keeping your fingerprint or your clumsy thumbprint off the text is an important part of it.
So in terms of understanding the voice of the author, this means reading the work from the beginning to the end first, just once or several times to get the sense of the voice?
That depends on the work. Sometimes you can establish a lot from an initial read. Sometimes the voice comes, and sometimes it's very, very difficult to discern the voice.
Mm-hmm.
Gregor von Rezzori is a remarkably complicated voice, and that I puzzled and puzzled and puzzled.
Mm-hmm. But when you translate it, when you're translating into another register, what is the register or the other key? Are you translating it into American? Are you translating it into English? You live in St. Louis. And are you translating it into something that people in the Midwest of the United States recognize?
No, I write in, by default, I write in American English. That's what I, but sometimes there is a hint of foreignness, or there's a hint of the past, a hint of another age, just a faint whiff of some other place, or is it an intentional obsolete phrase, or is it an echo of a biblical saying, and all of these things get layered into the translation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How about you, Ari? What is the language you're translating into? Because Italian is a fairly recent language, in the sense that living in Italy, I see that there are plenty of people still who speak their dialects in Rome, in Napoli, where you're from. What is the Italian that you translate, for instance, the Bible into?
My mother tongue is Neapolitan. Mm-hmm. I was born in Neapolitan. and I spoke Neapolitan with my mother, exactly. And my father's tongue is Italian, because my father taught us to speak Italian, to talk Italian with him in the house, at the table, without accent. It was all a different language. It was a silent language, a quiet language. And the Neapolitan was very loudy and was very quick and short. And we have also the fastest of the word, most fast verb of the word. The verb to go in Neapolitan is I. Mm-hmm. So it's also the English to go is double long. So it was a very urgent language, and it depends, as Yiddish too, depends on the overcrowded situation of the place you live in.
Okay, I mean, can you give an example? For instance, that God's first command in Genesis, "Let there be light," Yihior. How would you translate that into Italian, and how into Neapolitan? What would be the difference?
In Italian is sarà luce.
Sarà luce, okay.
And Neapolitan is quite the same. Uh-huh. So short, sarà luce, sì.
In Romanaccio it would be che cazzo sole. Is that right? No,
the most important moment of that tense, yeah, is the fact that the divinity says sarà luce, yei or will be the light. Mm-hmm. Why does he say? Can is not sufficient his will to turn the light on? Mm-hmm. He has to say, because his words switch the light on. Is the word of the divinity before the 6 days of creation that get the creation effective, real. So in that language, the word is exactly the accomplished deed. This is the highest responsibility for the our tool word, a word that makes the things happen.
Right.
So far from politics, exactly. For example.
Let me ask you about one word there, because it's always, in ancient Hebrew, there are several words for the divinity, for God. And in that first sentence, they use the word Elohim, which is a plural form, isn't it? Elohim is a plural form, and many people have said this is a holdover from ancient religions in which it was many gods who said, "Let there be light." How do you confront that in translation?
Elohim is just divinity, means divinity. It is not a name exactly of exclusive of the God of the Bible, because there are also Elohim others Elohim. But in this case, in our case, Elohim is this plural name as verbs in the singular case. Mm-hmm. Bereshit bara Elohim, crea Elohim. Mm-hmm. Created Elohim, so it's a singular tense, and this is just a generic name of divinity.
So it was bad grammar, but you can't fix the grammar in the Hebrew.
His true name is the tetragram,
uh-huh, right,
that is formed by four letters that must not be spoken. Right. We translate them with God.
Now, you translated the Bible not because you're a believer. You don't actually believe in God, but why?
I make it a slight, is a little difference between not believer and atheist. Uh-huh. Because not believer is someone as me that eliminates divinity from its life, is my life, but not from the life of the others. I think that the believer is someone who has an intimacy, a relationship that I have not, among the many, many relationships I have not.
Right.
And the atheist is someone who eliminates the divinity also from the life of the others. And I am just only a non-believer.
So you would say that you're not necessarily dealing with a dead author when you're dealing with the Bible?
With
a dead author. I mean, is the author is not coming to you and saying, Eddie, at night,
in Revelation,
saying, no, you translated that wrong.
No. The author, because there is an author, has given the work to the some redactors. But so I have a relationship with the redactors.
And their heirs aren't coming after you. Their families aren't attacking you.
The agent.
The agent for the redactor. How about, but Philip?
Maybe they appreciate.
Philip, you deal with living authors mostly. Do they come after you after you've done a translation? Yet?
Not yet. There's always a delicate balance, and I deal with both. With a living author, I'm fortunate to be able to. I'm friends with some of them, and I'm in touch with others. Most authors have a very good sense of what this is about, and there are, however, some who are armed with a certain amount of, say, English, and they might look over your shoulder, but generally the experienced authors know, you know, it's a matter of trust, and they're delivering this into your trust, and then you are writing this book anew in your language, and they understand that. And the great thing with the living authors, you know, I can ask questions. I have to ask questions, and very often, especially in German, German is a language where words, you know, take the word, while we're on biblical themes, take the word Himmel, which in English can be heaven, or it can be simply sky. And sometimes having to determine which one it is, because in German it can be both at once. And I might consult with an author, well, what's the general trend here, and how do you feel this? Or translating works where there might be very specific references. A book by Christoph Hein where he's describing how he was attacked on the eastern border of Germany once, and I went to his house and he said, well, here's the place where all this happened, because this all really happened to me. And he pointed, because topography is always very difficult when you have a description of a room, because you know, you all might walk out of this space and each one of you would describe this space differently, and then I have to somehow envision from your descriptions what this room looked like and then create a new description in English, so it won't, it, you know, seeing it and having that confirmation from Christoph made that a little more tangible.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a question that I was going to ask Edie, Edie Grossman, who had never been to South America. How can you translate Garcia Marquez without ever having seen the place in the same way that you talked about Christoph Heim? How important is it? Was that experience for you in that case?
Well, it's also our ability to imagine, and some of the books take us to places that are very imaginary or very they're places that may not exist in reality. So in those cases, our inventiveness comes into play. Often, I've had to deal with places that no longer exist. A book about a Polish author wrote a book called "In English, Death in Danzig," and it's about the city of Danzig as it became the city of Gdańsk, what happened before, during, and right after World War II there, and the presence of the German place names in the streets, and how those names were erased and how they were replaced with Polish names, and what the German language sounds to the Polish ear, and how do we get that in the English translation? So for that, I immersed myself I used to live in Poland, so I'd been to Gdańsk many times, but of course I had not been in Danzig in the 1930s, so I had to go back into maps, or writing about the Warsaw Ghetto. I have to absorb the topography of the ghetto and see what that was like. So it's a matter of immersing in that time.
So
and
sometimes
place.
You say when you use that image of the translator taking a work in one key and transposing it into another key. Sometimes it also means transposing it into the voice of Mozart or Beethoven or another composer from another time.
Right, we have to be alert to those voices, right?
Yeah. What about, I was asking you before, Peter Cooper, the graphic novelist, is here at the Hay Festival with a graphic novel of Kafka's Metamorphosis. Mm-hmm. And so we've been talking about the first line of Metamorphosis and about this funny word, Ungeziefer.
Ungeheuer's Ungeziefer
that Gregor Samsa is turned into. And I remember first reading as a child as the word cockroach. And since, as a New York child, we were all too intimate with cockroaches, I was seeing Gregor Samsas all over the place. But
What do you do with that word?
I've
always wanted to translate it with a bit of a Texan accent. And he woke up and he found himself changed into a great big bug.
Great big bug. With two U's. Is that right?
A great big bug.
The boll weevil, right? So,
well, not, but a bug would be a bug. A bug is also kind of...
That says it for the...
Yeah.
Well, that's, but in a way, what you're saying is that you're also translating for a particular audience. It's not just translating from a particular time,
but into some ways. But to capture that, Kafka is very often precisely vague that in all of his works. And in order to capture that precise vagueness, sometimes we have to invent. You know, I've seen the word vermin used for that Ungeziefer as well. Mm-hmm. So it's a matter of coming up with the right. Another one is Schnaps. You know, Schnaps. If in German, Schnaps is a kind of a generic term. But if you say it in the United States, it means this horrid peppermint Schnaps that people sometimes drink. Mm-hmm. And how do you get these general terms? You know, one word that might substitute for something else. And with Kafka, that comes up a lot.
Yeah, I recently saw a new opera based on the Metamorphosis, written by Silvia Colasanti, a young Italian composer, done up at the Maggio Musicale in Florence, in which Gregor was played by a dancer, but was sung by a narrator, but with a chorus of 12 men behind whose voices were synthesized. And both of you have worked in other mediums in which you've transposed literature into, let's say, theater or airy. You're doing something now with, you're writing an opera based on a psalm, is that correct? You were telling me that you've written an opera, you've added music to one of the psalms, is that correct?
Yes, I wrote a text for the second century of Verdi birthday.
The Requiem.
The Requiem. Uh-huh. And I wrote a text about the opposite, resurrection. And I exploited the chapter 37 of Ezekiel. Mm-hmm. That's a moment in which all the bones of a valley are invested by a wind that covers them with flesh and blood and they live again. So mm-hmm. it's a wonderful moment of the highest peak of resurrection in the Holy Bible. So I exploited this moment to translate it. But I was when you asked how could you translate Garcia Marquez if you have never been in Colombia?
No, that's a very good question. I mean, I've been there are a few words. There are a few wonderful words. I don't know if you run into the particular word cachaco. Huh? Have you heard this word cachaco? How many cachacos in the audience today?
Cachato.
Cachaco.
Cachato.
Okay. Cachacos are people from Bogota. Generally, but it means something much more than that. And Gregory Rabassa, who translated 100 Years of Solitude, he put the word arrogant people in there. And I'm sure you cachacos say, no, that's wrong. I had a discussion with this wonderful Italian journalist, Daniel Samper Pisano, who is a cachaco. And explained that cachaco, the word comes from the word jacket. And it all of a sudden occurred to me, and you may appreciate this because you translate from Yiddish, my father-in-law is a German Jew. German Jews, who were very upright, very straight, he would never sit the way I'm sitting, he would be talking like this. And the term for German Jews is Yekka.
Yekka.
I mean, you hear the sound, Yekka. For those of us who are Eastern European Jews, there's no worse sound in the language than Yekka. As the way for you costeños, there's no worse sound in the language than cachaco. But it comes from the word Yaka, which means jacket. It's the same idea. These are the people who wear jackets, who are all dressed up. They don't wear guayaberas. They don't wear sandals. Isn't that right, you cachacos? You all wear jackets? But Edie has certainly met plenty of cachacos, but you're absolutely right. How does one do this when you haven't? And yet she is seen as being a wonderful, wonderful translator of Garcia Marquez. And maybe it has to do with what you were saying, Philip, is...
But does it mean that you cannot translate Solzhenitsyn or Shalamov if you were not in a lager in Kolyma?
Well, that's right, if you don't have the experience. Well, do you know there's a famous story of Dustin Hoffman and Laurence Olivier when they were filming The Marathon Man? Do you know the story, Philip? Yeah. Where Dustin Hoffman had to turn up for a scene in which Olivier was playing a former concentration camp guard or former Gestapo who was about to remove Dustin Hoffman's teeth, and he had to turn up sort of entirely bedraggled as if he hadn't slept for 3 days. And so Dustin Hoffman turned up and he hadn't slept for 3 days. And Olivier said to him, "Dustin, you look terrible. You know, what have you done?" He says, "Well, you know, I've got to do this because I haven't slept for 3 days, so I have to be as if I didn't sleep for 3 days." He said, "How else could I do this?" And he said, "You could try acting, dear boy." And I think that's maybe the story, is that the imagination is a big part of this.
That's true. There's another part of the hearing, that each language has its own personality. So when we're adjusting, sometimes, for instance, the flourishes that abound in Spanish of all, from all places. I mean, imagine translating verde que te quiero verde into English. It's going to sound a little, I mean, if you translate that literally, it's going to sound a little odd. But and there's a certain amount of enthusiasm that the Anglo-Saxon world wants to dampen. And, you know, Polish has a kind of rustling sound. I mean, in Polish is a tongue twister in Polish. And those sounds, there's a personality behind that sound. You know, in German, sometimes it's like a huge Lego land where you take words apart and you put them back together and you have to kind of make that work. And, you know, and then there's Russian where I heard Brodsky once recite a poem, and when he was the poet laureate of the United States for a while, but he was reading and he read this poem in the very Anglo-Saxon manner, and he said, he got up there and he read, "My father, blah, 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 blah." And then he said, "I will now read the poem in Russian." And he stood up and he said, "Otchets mui." And then it was a very different poem. And how do we then work those linguistic differences in, and the idea that we're flattening? I mean, sometimes I'm frightened how much English flattens language.
Really?
Because I often, especially the Romance languages and the Slavic languages, they get...
Yeah. Mm. When you translated Herta Müller, were you conscious that you were therefore flattening?
Well, Herta Müller is a very special case. I hope I wasn't flattening, but trying to capture the... she has a sharpness in her words, and that sharpness is very taut. It's like it's very tensile and strong, like steel, and it's cut. And sometimes the phrases are put together, and we wouldn't normally put them together. But when they're put together, there's this great deal of energy, and trying to find the language that would contain that energy that is then released when you read it in English is what translating that prose was about for me. Mm.
I was asking you before about the beginning of her new novel, or of her latest novel, The Hunger Angel, as it's called in English, Atemschaukel in German, which is, I think, all that I have, I carry on me, or all that is mine, I carry with me. Mm. And it did have the feeling of poetry. Do you remember how that was in the German?
Yeah. Alles, was ich habe, trage ich bei mir. Alles, das meine trage ich mit mir. I think was the German. But
you were also saying that you think it had a
there's
Latin origin.
There's an echo of a Latin a recorded saying that a philosopher was reduced to, you know, it being banished from town. But this is a saying. So there's an echo, and there's a theme in the book. The narrator of the book, Leo Albeck, took Latin, and he refers to his Latin class. So I deliberately wanted to have a hint of some proverbial weight to those first two lines.
Mm-hmm. Did you have anything to do with the choice of the title in English?
Yes, I did. I have to confess that I did some of that. It was a very impossible task because Atemschaukel is one of these words that we can't, breath swing would say nothing really in English. It would leave great puzzlement. And so we ran through different possibilities, and since that theme seemed to be such an important one in the book, and sometimes the idea of the titles distilling the work itself is important. Plus, the editor, Sarah Burstell, who's responsible for bringing so many works from all over the world into English, she and I labored over this, but we also have to get approval because the publishing house has to say, okay, we can market that title. So there was a back and forth, and this is finally what we were able to do.
Now, I mean, there's something very much, I think you're absolutely right, there's something very poetic about Herta Müller's language. My big question is, am I reading Herta Müller or am I reading Philip Boehm when I read that poetry? This maybe goes back to what Ari was saying about admiring or envying there. I mean, when people review these books, do you want them to say that they're reading Herta Müller? Do you want them to say that they're reading Philip Boehm? Or what do you want them to say?
Well, that they're reading this book, and that this book is moving them in whatever way the book would move them. And of course, that they're reading Herta's prose and recognizing that it's been, you know, gone through so many reviewers fail to recognize that it's back to, you know, well, if English was good enough for Jesus Christ, it's good enough for the school children of Texas, how I know that one.
Yeah.
But, you know, and people are, they just assume that things were written especially in English. They assume things were written in English. And so for them to recognize that there is another step might help improve the number of books, the percentage of books that gets translated into English, which is notoriously low.
What about when the subject is poetry? Eddie, you've translated Yiddish poetry into Italian,
also,
correct?
Also, yeah.
Is that a very different kind of translation than, say, when you were translating books of the Bible?
Of course, books of the Bible I translate with the most strictly fidelity. Also in the place of the words. When you say, and God said, in ancient Hebrew is always "and said God," and this is important for me and for the book and for the text, because the revelation of the divinity is through his words. That's his most important manifestation. So the fact that is at the top of the tense is important. Before is his manifestation, then before the prophets hear the voices, and then they understand the owner of the voice.
Right.
Yeah. So in the Bible, in the translation, I am very strictly on the matter. From the Yiddish, it depends on the authors. Mm-hmm. Depends on the authors, on their rhythm, and with a kind of familiarity that I feel between Yiddish and Neapolitan.
Now, why do you feel that they're similar? I mean, I've got to say, I eat much better in Naples than I ate at my grandparents' house. What's the similarity between Yiddish and Neapolitan?
Both are languages that will come from a very overcrowded place.
They're spoken.
And so, when you are within a kind of perpetual market, mm-hmm. you have to talk and to have language short, modulation, and with the gestures that push your words in the towards the people, and so you can follow 10 conversations at the moment, in mm-hmm. the same moment. And so then this is this overcrowded situation. Makes the same effects. They are both very superstitious,
mm-hmm.
and maybe Yiddish more superstitious than Neapolitan. They love theater because the life when it's so crowded is theater. You have to have a role, a character that nobody can. Confondere, come dice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But they're both in a way dying languages. There are a few. They're both dying languages.
No, the Yiddish has been a killed language.
Yeah.
The Neapolitan is dying slowly,
mm-hmm.
and it's still is still speaking in old fashion. Among the immigrants all around the world. Now, Yiddish has been a killed language, so that's why I learned it.
Yeah.
Because the only one thing that can make someone who came after this destruction is to learn this language, move again the lips of this language, sing again in Yiddish. No?
I mean, do you feel, in a way, both of you, that translators are like firemen who are rescuing books from burning houses, that you have a mission to rescue these dying books. You mentioned one book by Isaac Bashevis Singer that had a final chapter that had never been translated, correct?
Yes, yeah. But I feel someone like in Yiddish you say packenträger. Means
porter.
A porter.
A porter. Yeah. A porter. Yeah. So I. I take on me, on my shoulders, the pack.
That kind of responsibility.
And I move it to the.
And for you, Philip, I mean, your decision to learn German and Polish when you were young, was that with some kind of sense of mission?
Oh, I don't know if I had a sense of mission. I fell into translation somewhat by chance. But certain books are with a definite sense of mission. Sometimes the publishers come to me with a request, and sometimes I go to them. So there are certain books that definitely become a mission. And then,
I mean, it's a very difficult mission in the United States. I think the numbers are something like 2% of the books in the United States are translated from a foreign language. I think in Italy the number is much higher than that. So
that's why we are the good translators.
Yeah.
Because we have a lot to understand, to import from other literatures.
Yeah.
We are a small language, and so if we want to know other stories, other literatures, we have to translate them.
Well, in a country, Hungary, for instance, there's so many things being translated. But in English, it's ironic that we don't have the that we have so few titles.
Yeah, I mean, what do you ever speak to your publishers and say?
Oh, it's often the publishers. Certain publishers want very much to bring these books out, but they're beholden because of the acquisition, the way the publishing industry has changed in the last couple of decades, with little companies being acquired by larger concerns, so that what used to function as list subsidy, where certain best-selling books would allow the publisher to publish books that would not otherwise be published, some of the once these companies were acquired, the powers that be look at the bottom line and they say, well, let's make all books best-selling books, and so then the cutoff is different.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, I mean, thinking of modernity here, that that things like Google Translate are making your lives harder?
I haven't seen Google Translate novels, so that's a...
Right. Let's hope not. Yeah.
But I wanted to say one thing back to some of the questions. Yeah. With Herta's prose and poetry, there's an aspect of this listening that sometimes we have to translate silence, because many good works have these spaces, these silence, and that's where I think it's Octavio Paz has this line about where poetry lies, and he says, if I remember, entre lo que veo y digo, and then he goes on and he says, entre lo que digo y callo, que callo y sueño, entre lo que sueño y olvido, that in this space there is this poetry and those silent spaces. It's also in Rilke, you know, Doch selbst in der Verschweigung, in the Sonnet Orpheus, or Mandelstam. It's all about silence. And when we translate, sometimes it's a matter of beholding those silent spaces and letting us absorb that. And that's a very important part. And as a musician, you of course, mm-hmm. know the importance of the silence
No, it's interesting you mentioned that. One of our guest journalists was writing a piece about Herta Müller and wrote about her sentences being in German and her silences being in German as well.
Absolutely.
And the only question that brings up is, what does German mean?
Right.
And,
well,
and what does it mean to you or to you right. or right. to anybody else there?
Right.
Yeah. Well, we've talked for a while, so I thought we'd use a few minutes here. We've got about 20 minutes left to see if there are any questions from the audience, things that you've been pondering. There are a few people with microphones, so raise your hand. I think we have a few over here.
Hi, my name is Maria Antonia Garces. I'm a professor at Cornell University, and I'll translate into Spanish
Sorry,
now.
Sorry, can we make the volume a little louder? And I'm sorry, we don't have any earphones, so if your questions can be in English, that would be great.
Okay. My name is Maria Antonia Garces. I'm a professor at Cornell University, and I have a question for both speakers. Philip, you mentioned that you fell into translation by chance. What is your background? How did you come into translation? And the same for Mr. De Luca. I have the feeling that Mr. De Luca is an academic, but that may be a misrepresentation.
I heard most of that, but not all of that. Maybe
nothing.
Heard nothing. Okay. What is the background of both of you? How did you fall, or how did you go into translation?
Uh-huh. Well, as I say, I fell into it backwards. I'm a theater director.
Sorry, let me just repeat the question so Eddie can understand. Mm. What was your background before you started translating, and how did you begin to translate?
Yeah.
Okay.
And in my case, I'm a theater director and was living in Poland at a time where I was getting paid in socialist zlotys, and I was passing through New York, and I couldn't even take that out of the country, so I needed some work, and a friend said, here's a book. Maybe you should submit a sample. And that was a book by Ingeborg Bachmann. And I submitted the sample, and I wound up getting that book. And then I somehow have been translating ever since. So that's for me.
Well, for me, it has been an unlucky start, because I was forced as a young boy to learn Latin and Greek at school. And so this strong rules and laws of the translation I suffered when I studied, and then have been useful to move in other languages easily, and to move towards languages and poets that I loved. So it's I can bless my unlucky start.
How old were you when you started learning ancient Hebrew?
Ancient Hebrew, I started studying it in half life ago.
A half life ago.
And I used to read ancient Hebrew every day, waking up. I need to wake up myself in ancient Hebrew and Neapolitan coffee. Both the combination is able to make me woken up.
But this makes me actually raise another question, because in the United States there is a vogue for playwrights who maybe don't speak the language they're translating from to translate plays. For instance, David Mamet, the American playwright, has translated Chekhov. Philip, I see you love this idea. what do you really think about it?
Well, I mean, since I'm working in the theater and also as a playwright and as a translator, I'm always thinking there's something. I mean, sometimes those are adaptations. They've hired someone to give them a sense, and it depends. So it may be very often these are, you see their stamp on the play more than perhaps we would wish. And so it's a different, it becomes a different theatrical performance, but it's, we see the same when directors put on plays and they've taken, say, Shakespeare. Herta and Harry and I were just talking about a Shakespeare production in Berlin where, well, it wasn't so much Shakespeare as that director's changing so many things, and there's that tendency. I have a bit of a distance to that.
Right. Another question over here? Yes, he has the microphone, so he wins. Sorry.
Good morning. To Philip, I have a question. When you translate these authors, which is the more difficult part, or the accuracy or the feeling, which is the one that concerns?
The question, just to repeat it, was when Philip translates, which is more important, the accuracy or the feeling?
And for Mr. De Luca, which has been the hardest book of the Bible to translate? Thank you. And why?
And for Ari, which was the hardest book, the most difficult book to translate from the Bible?
Okay. I didn't translate it all the Bible. I just translated the books, some books. And Exodus, Ruth, Kohelet, and as a reader, the hardest book of to translate is the book of Job.
Book of Job.
Yeah. Book of Job, because it's full of the guasti, come on, the
of mistakes,
corrupted the text.
Yeah, corrupt, yeah.
Corrupted text is the hardest to translate, and so I couldn't afford it. But for me, there are no difficult texts in ancient Hebrew. It was is a kind language for and I understand why the divinity has put all his eggs in this language.
To your question, I hope that sometimes that achieving the accuracy is also achieving the feeling that is intended. And there's a constant interpretation. It's also how you read, because when you read, as we read books, each one of us is translating that in our own way. And we're making those decisions. Sometimes there is sometimes I'll have to give up something here, but it's a kind of principle of household management. If I have to skimp here, maybe I'll add something here if it's in order to preserve something that was in the book originally, not adding something of my own, but just if I lose a layer here and I can reassert that layer in another word. For instance, I was translating a Brecht play, and there was a line from a book that wouldn't make any sense in English, and I had to substitute something. So I began, the play involves a librarian, and so I insert a line from Dickens, it was the best of times. And that happened to be the last line of the Brecht play anyway, although he wasn't talking about Dickens, but it added an echo, and it allowed something to happen in the translation that may not have happened in the German, but perhaps was in the spirit of that play.
Yeah, I mean, it feels a little bit like you're solving a crossword puzzle of some sort, and just getting all the pieces in the right place.
Very often,
yeah. Yeah. Other questions? Out here.
Hello? Hello? Can you hear me? Okay, well, thank you for being here. It's really magical to have you, the three of you, in our country and on the stage. That was my first thing. But I have a question about a favorite language. Is there such thing as, I love translating from one language into another better than others? I mean, how do you handle so much information in your mind? And I'm just curious of that part of, is there an easier language to translate into or something that makes more sense from one language to another?
Okay, so the question is, I think, do you each have a favorite language to translate from? Do you prefer ancient Hebrew or Yiddish?
Ancient Hebrew. Ancient Hebrew.
Ancient Hebrew.
Because it's a closed language. It doesn't move more anymore. So I can be faithful to the single word. I do not translate using the dictionary. I translate using the another kind of tool. That's like concordanza.
Mm-hmm. The concordance.
Concordance. I follow the single Hebrew word in all the places it occurs. And this biography of the word makes me clear the word that I have used in Italian.
Mm-hmm. And for you, Philip, between Polish and German?
It depends on the book. I often look for Polish things because Polish is more rarely translated, and so there are, it's an opportunity, whereas more German books get translated, but it depends very much on the book. Occasionally, I'll venture into other languages, but it really depends on the subject, always into English, though. Well, I did translate into Polish a long time ago theater works, but that's a different story.
Do you can you work on two different languages at the same time, or is that very difficult? I have two projects going, one in Polish and one in German, or one in Yiddish and one in Hebrew. Yeah.
Yes, it's easy to switch from a language to another. Yes.
It's at certain stages, it's okay.
Yeah,
it's
right. Yeah. Other questions?
Hello. You never mentioned French. There are many writers, poets, philosophers, French philosophers and writers. Why don't you translate them?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that? We couldn't understand that.
There are many good writers, philosophers, and poets, French philosophers, and you never mentioned French translation into French or from French to Spanish or English. Why?
Oh, we never mentioned translating from French or Spanish into
right.
English. Is that the? I think the simple answer is because our guests today translate from German and Polish, and Yiddish, and Hebrew. But do you have opinions about this in terms of translations from French and Spanish into English? As Wittgenstein said, you know, about what we cannot speak, we should remain silent. And
I dearly wish I spoke French, and I have translated, I shouldn't admit this, but I have translated from Spanish theater works as well.
Well, what did you translate?
Cocinando con Elisa es una obra teatral de Lucía Larrajone de Argentina.
Uh-huh. But you don't enjoy doing it anymore?
No, I do. It's just that I feel embarrassed.
Tengo mucho miedo de comprometerme en español, entonces no voy a seguir con
eso. So you're all inviting him to spend more time with you here. Mm-hmm. At least the costeños are. The cachacos say go home. But, mm-hmm. but
there are also other languages. In some of the plays that I've done, I've explored Quechua. Mm-hmm. There was a person at the University of Warsaw who taught Quechua. So I can ask you, to this day, I can ask you if you are from Urubamba. But I've explored a little bit of that, those worlds, and these are languages that I think are there, but they don't have a sufficient representation in our literary world. So there's another whole area of exploration.
No, and in fact, back in Rome, Eddie, I have a friend who is a linguistic anthropologist who is dedicated to preserving languages, dying languages, various dialects. You can apparently travel across the entire, from northern Italy across southern France to into Spain, speaking dialect, and you will be understood. But these dialects are all dying out, so these are good things to do. Other questions? In the back, maybe?
Oh, hello. This is for both of our panelists. I'm wondering if there are any authors that you're familiar with who seem particularly difficult to translate for whatever reason, whether it's style or language. And also I'm wondering if there are any, if to the extent that you can comment, any of your fellow translators where you look at the translation and you think that it falls short or could be redone in a more appropriate fashion.
Okay, so the question was, are there any authors who are particularly difficult to translate, and have you ever read works by other translators that you felt weren't as good as what you would do?
Sometimes I move to my translation because I am not happy of the other translations. Mm-hmm. But not that mine is better, but I want to have my translation. But I am not I am an amateur. I can spend all one day to translate just one Hebrew verse. So if a professional translator would die by starving in this way.
They do so, anyway.
Anyway.
And Philip, is there anybody who you find particularly difficult to translate?
There are a lot of authors that I come across that are, they might be difficult, so difficult because perhaps their work wouldn't travel, it wouldn't be able to mean anything if it were to land on our shores. And then there are also authors who are, linguistic wordplay, like Khlebnikov, the Russian, that's very hard to do. Imagine translating Lewis Carroll into other languages. I mean, there's sometimes absurdities that you have to completely reinvent. So there are cases like that, but usually it's a matter of assessing how is this work going to give something to the reader? Is it going to resonate?
Okay, I think we have time for one last question, maybe in the back. Somewhere there? There we go.
Thank you. What happens with authors that write in some sort of mixed language? I'm thinking of Junot Diaz in The Wonderful and Short Life of Oscar Wilde. This novel is written in English and Spanish and some sort of Caribbean. Or, for example, Jonathan Safran Foer in Everything is Illuminated. Some parts of the novel are written in English, but it's an interpretation of English from Ukrainian. How to translate that without missing like the rhythms and the puns that comes from a novel that it's commenting on translation actually.
Did you understand that?
No.
She was talking about, I think, two novels in particular, Juno Diaz's Oscar Wao and Everything's Illuminated, Jonathan Safran Foer, in which the way in which the characters speak is often a mongrel version of the language. How do you translate that into another language? Do you mongrelize the language you're translating it into?
It's like using spices. A little bit goes a long way. So you have to have a delicate touch, but it can be done.
Yeah, I mean, Eri, you know the novels of the Sicilian writer Camilleri, the detective novels, which are written in a sort of Sicilian dialect. I've seen them translate into English as if they're speaking in Brooklyn with these and those, and it's one of the most horrible experiences. I mean, I find it easier to read the Sicilian than to read the English translation. But so I think Philip's right. A little spice goes a long way in translation.
I think that you have to leave the words in original and then use a kind of dictionary. Mm-hmm. And
to be an active reader. Mm. Well, listen, let me close by urging you all to be active readers, to go out. Many of you don't find this hard, but go find a book in translation and go buy it and read it. And when you go back to wherever you go back to, whether it's the United States or Italy or Cachacolandia or wherever you live, you know, insist on translated books, because it's one of the reasons that we can bring more people like you to international festivals and to meet people like Philip Baim and Eri Di Luca. Thank you very much.
Y por mi parte, quisiera agradecer a los organizadores de este festival, ustedes por venir, también a los intérpretes que por su ayuda. Entonces, muchas gracias.